Right, so we'll do Refuge and Bodhicitta, and then Four Immeasurables and Seven Limb Prayer and Mandala Offering. Okay, remember that before you say this prayer, you think about what you're doing. It's not just an empty ritual. It's like you get a refuge for because of your, you have confidence in the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, and you have fear or dread or you, whatever word you want to use for the, you know, with the kind of mind you have, and assuming we're all ordinary people here with the kind of minds we have, and we're caught up in this whole cycle of rebirth and reincarnation, life after life, out of control, completely out of control, and it's not going to go well. So we have to have some dread of what our lives are going to look like in the future unless we do something. And then we have faith that the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha is that something, you know, it's sort of what we need to do. We need to take refuge in the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, and that's the way out. So it's that plus compassion for yourself and all beings. Those are said to be the attitudes to have as we do this prayer. I go for refuge until I'm enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I'm enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I'm enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. The Four Immeasurables. May all sentient beings have happiness and the causes of happiness. May all sentient beings be free from suffering and the causes of suffering. May all sentient beings be inseparable from the happiness that is free from suffering. And may all sentient beings abide in equanimity, free from attachment for friends and hatred for enemies. Reverently, I prostrate with my body, speech, and mind. I present clouds of every type of offering, actual and imagined. I declare all my negative actions accumulated since beginning this time and rejoice in the merit of all holy and ordinary beings. Please remain until the end of cyclic existence and turn the wheel of Dharma for living beings. I dedicate my own merits and those of all others to the great enlightenment. Short mandala offering. This ground, anointed with perfume, strewn with flowers, adorned with Mount Meru, four continents, the sun, and the moon. I imagine this as a Buddha field and offer it. May all living beings enjoy this pure land. Idam Guru Ratna Mandala Kamne Yata Yame. Now, we'll do the do the three principal aspects of the path. And just also, you know, I may pause after each stanza just so you can sort of just mentally, just quickly touch on what this means to you. We'll see. Expressing homage. I bow down to my perfect gurus. The essential meaning of the victorious one's teachings, the path praised by all the holy victors and their children, the gateway of the fortunate ones desiring liberation, this I shall try to explain as much as I can. Those who are not attached to the pleasures of circling, who strive to make freedom and endowments meaningful, who entrust themselves to the path pleasing the victorious ones, you fortunate ones listen with a calm mind. Without the complete intention definitely to be free from circling, there is no way to pacify attachment seeking pleasurable effects in the ocean of circling. Also, by craving for cyclic existence, embodied beings are continuously bound. Therefore, at the very beginning, seek renunciation. Freedom and endowments are difficult to find, and life has no time to spare. By gaining familiarity with this, attraction to the appearances of this life is reversed. Thinking over and over again that actions and their effects are unbetraying, and repeatedly contemplating the miseries of cyclic existence, attraction to the appearances of future lives is reversed. When by having trained in that way there is no arising, even for a second, of attraction to the perfections of cyclic existence, and all day and night the intention seeking liberation arises, then the thought of renunciation has been generated. Even if renunciation has been developed, if it is not possessed by the mind of enlightenment, it does not become the cause of the perfect bliss of unsurpassed enlightenment. Therefore, the wise generate the supreme mind of enlightenment. Swept away by the current of four powerful rivers, tied by the tight bonds of karma so hard to undo, caught in the iron net of self-grasping, completely enveloped by the total darkness of ignorance, endlessly reborn in cyclic existence, ceaselessly tormented by the three sufferings, thinking that all mothers are in such a condition, generate the supreme mind of enlightenment. If, like the mother whose cherished son has fallen into a pit of fire and who experiences even 1 second of his suffering as an unbearable eternity, your reflection on the suffering of all mother sentient beings has made it impossible for you to bear their suffering for even 1 second, and the wish seeking enlightenment for their sake arises without effort, then you have realized the supreme precious mind of enlightenment. Without the wisdom realizing ultimate reality, even though you have generated renunciation and the mind of enlightenment, you cannot cut the root cause of circling. Therefore, attempt the method to realize dependent arising. One who sees the cause and effect of all phenomena of both cyclic existence and the state beyond sorrow as forever unbetraying, and for whom any object trusted in by the grasping mind has completely disappeared, has at that time entered the path pleasing the Buddhas. If the appearance of dependent relation, which is unbetraying, is accepted separately from emptiness, and as long as they were seen as separate, then one still has not realized the Buddha's intent. If these two realizations were happening simultaneously without alternation, and for merely seeing dependent relation as completely unbetraying, the definite ascertainment comes that completely destroys the way all objects are apprehended as truly existent. At that time, the analysis of the ultimate view is complete. Furthermore, appearance eliminates the extreme of existence, and emptiness eliminates the extreme of non-existence. If you realize how emptiness manifests in the manner of cause and effect, then you are not captivated by wrong notions holding extreme views. In this way, you realize exactly the vital points of the three principal aspects of the path, resort to seeking solitude, generate the power of effort, and quickly accomplish your final goal, my child. So I know that the last part on emptiness is pretty heavy, but if you read a commentary, it sort of unpacks it and makes it comprehensible, because lots of times these texts that are written like this in poetic format, you might say, are very cryptic. They don't give you a whole lot of information, but there's still quite a bit. You know, it's still potentially understandable. So now we're going to do a couple of, I'm sure people are complaining that we haven't done any meditation. So we're going to do, we'll start out with just mindfulness of the breath. And then I'm going to read through this Duma sheet. And I don't know if people have it or not, but I'll read through it one time. Then we'll go back and do it again. But just want you to, you know, understand what we're doing. I think most people have it, but maybe not. So we'll do that. But we'll start out by just doing some mindfulness meditation. Again, you can, oftentimes it's easiest just to use your breath as the object, but it's, you know, it's always there, it's always changing, so you can follow your breath or any other object you choose. So the the ultimate, the most important aspect of tantric practice, according to Lama Yeshe, is bodhicitta, is to have this awakening mind, because that's really the motivation for practicing tantra. Should be, as it just whatever degree we can generate it. It's like we want to be happy. We want to be able to be of the greatest possible service to all other beings, and that's just not to help them with their temporal needs, but to help them with their ultimate needs, which is the need to solve their own problems and find their own sort of inner liberation and enlightenment. So we really want to be, we want to be that guy or that gal. We want to be that person who can guide people from suffering to supreme enlightenment. And to do that, we have to prepare ourselves. We have to do the work. And so, you know, a person who has a sense of urgency, like, look at all the suffering that's going on. The world is crazy. There's so much going on. You know, I'm suffering. Other beings are suffering. And I have, for some unforeseen reason, I have latched on to this amazing vehicle called Tantra, which is powerful and fast. And it's the quickest way to get enlightened. And so I can help others more quickly if I practice this path. So that's the motivation that gets it done. That's the most, it's the only reason to truly practice Tantra. And the only way you'll ever, will ever get results is with that attitude. That's that very sincere wish to help others as quickly as possible through becoming enlightened using the tantric methods. And so this inner heat practice is from It's actually taken from a Hatha Yoga Tantra. Remember, we talked about the four levels of Tantra? It's taken from Hatha Yoga Tantra, and it's taken from specifically some practices called the six yogas of Naropa. And they're actually they're yoga postures, like, you know, Hatha Yoga type postures that are incorporated in these six yogas. They're slightly different, but similar what you would recognize in a yoga class. But this particular practice is from the six yogas of Naropa, and meditators who do this practice well can, and Herbert Benson from Harvard, who's a cardiologist, has has videoed meditators who've been able to raise their skin temperature, I think like 113 degrees, something like that, from 98 Fahrenheit to about 113 degrees, raise their skin temperature while their core temperature remains normal, right, 98.6. So these are the, you know, these are people that practice this inner heat or Dumo practice. And it said that anybody who, you know, anybody I say, but somebody who's prepared themselves sufficiently can learn to do this in as little as 2 years. But anyway, you could, it is possible to do this very well. And this blissful energy that you can generate through this practice is meant to help focus the mind. When the mind's happy and blissful, it's content. So it's not scattered. And if you take a blissful, happy, contented mind and focus on reality, you can make huge progress in a very short time. So that's part of the thinking behind generating this blissful consciousness using this particular practice. So you sit comfortably. We'll just do it, and I'll read through it. So sit comfortably, your meditation posture, and determine to keep your mind relaxed, concentrated, and free of expectations for the entire session. Now we start by, you might want to look up here too, and I'll show you. Start by visualizing the central channel, and the Sanskrit word is Sushumna, and as a transparent tube of hollow light, a finger's breadth in diameter, it runs down from the center of the body, down through the center of the body, just in front of the spinal column, from the crown of the head to the base of the spine. So right here, it's like a hollow, transparent hollow tube. Now there's going to be two smaller tubes called the nadis that start at the right and left nostril. And they go back like an umbrella handle, you know? And they swing back from the nostril and goes up, and then they run down either side of the central channel. So visualize these left and right nadis slightly thinner than the central channel. Travel upwards to the top of the head, curve over and down toward either side of the central channel. They curve inwards and join the central channel at a point approximately 4 finger breadths below the level of the navel. So, you know, you'll notice most meditators in the Tibetan tradition, they put the left hand there, the right hand on top, and these fingers, these two hands are 4 finger breadths below the navel, and the thumbs are touching at the level of the navel. So like this. Making a little triangle like that. And the arms are slightly away from the body. And this is meant to help you with your visualization of this particular practice, actually, or one of the reasons. Now, as you just listen to this instruction first. Take as long as you like to construct this visualization. Once it is stable, imagine a red-hot ember the size of a tiny seed inside the central channel at the level of the navel. So that's going to be where your thumbs are touching. That should help you. Where your thumbs are touching, back about 5 or 6 inches, and just in front of the spine is this little red-hot ember inside the central channel. To strengthen this visualization, imagine reaching into a fire, taking out a tiny glowing ember, and placing it in your central channel. Once it is there, really feel its intense heat. So do that now. Huh. for whatever you feel. Maybe you feel heat, maybe you don't feel heat, maybe you feel a little bit, a lot. It doesn't matter. Whatever you get, you take. Don't make yourself wrong because you're not experiencing exactly what I'm saying. Now, in order to increase the heat, gently contract the muscles of the pelvic floor, concentrating on the internal rather than the external muscles. And in this way, bring air energy up from the lowest chakra, that is, energy wheel or center, to the ember. We're bringing energy up from the pelvic floor. It's kind of like a Kegel exercise. So you probably know what that is. Anyway, you contract the muscles of the pelvic floor, bringing that energy up to the ember. Next, you can relax for a second. Now, next, you gently take a full breath through the nostrils. The air travels from the nostrils through the right and left channels to where they enter the central channel below the level of the navel. So that's where your hands are, you know, stacked one on top of the other. Four finger breaths below the navel. That's where these nadis join the central channel. The air joins with the heat there and with energy brought up from below. So try to do this. Contract the pelvic muscles. Take a deep, full breath through the nostrils, and the air travels through the nostrils down the right and left channels until they enter the central channel, four finger breaths below the navel. Joins the heat there, brought up from below. Now relax. As you stop inhaling, immediately swallow. We'll do this on the next breath. As you stop inhaling, immediately swallow. So you inhale, and then you swallow. And as you swallow, you imagine pushing down gently with your diaphragm in order to firmly compress the energy brought from above. Now the air energy is completely locked in, compressed from above and below. So your diaphragm is pushing down, the muscles of the pelvic floor are being drawn upward. Sometimes it's called vase breathing, you know, because it's like the shape of a vase, but it's, and you just, you hold your breath at that point, and you just gently, you know, compress that energy. Hold your breath as long as it's comfortable. Concentrating completely on the ember at the navel area, whose heat is increasing and spreading as a result of the compressed air energy. When you need to exhale, relax the lightly tensed muscles and exhale gently and completely. And although the air leaves through the nostrils, visualize that it rises up through the central channel and dissolves there. As you exhale, imagine all that air coming right up the central channel and dissolving there. The heat emanating from the burning ember at the navel continually increases and spreads and starts to burn away the blockages at each chakra, our energy center, and starts also to warm the concentration of silvery, blissful energy found on the crown of the head. So imagine there's some silvery, blissful energy at the crown of your head, and that heat coming up from that ember, the blockages at the heart, There's a chakra here at the solar plexus, one at the heart, one at the throat, and there's one here. So as that energy, that heat's coming up and completely sort of opening up these blockages and really freeing up the central channel. However, the focal point of your concentration is always the heat of the burning ember at the navel. So you can, so once your first exhalation is complete, again, tighten the lower muscles. Inhale a second time. Swallow. Push down with the diaphragm. Thus again, compressing the air on the heat. Then exhale, releasing the air up the central channel once again. Repeat this 7 times. The intensity of the heat growing with each breath. So let's do this for a couple of minutes. You don't want to hold your breath so long that you end up going, you're just gasping out. You want to be kind of quiet so you're not disturbing other people. At the 7th exhalation, imagine a now burning hot ember explodes into flames. And they shoot up the central channel, completely consuming and purifying the diluted energy at each chakra. At the crown, the flames finally melt and release the silvery, blissful energy, which pours down the purified central channel, giving pleasure at each chakra it passes. Finally, when it meets the blazing ember at the navel chakra, there is an explosion of bliss. This blissful heat flows out to every atom and cell of your body, completely filling you, making your mind very happy. So again, the flames go from the ember, go up the central channel, melting the silvery blissful energy, which then comes down the central channel, giving pleasure at each chakra passes. Finally, it meets the blazing ember at the navel, and there's an explosion of bliss. And whatever you experience, just allow that experience to happen. You would notice that no matter how strong the pleasure is, your mind and body are calm and controlled. Unlike our usual experience of physical pleasure, where the mind is excited and uncontrolled. If your mind should wander from its concentration to other objects, the past or future, objects of attachment or aversion, focus your attention on the subject of the thought, the mind that perceives the distraction, the thinker. Watch the subject until the distracting thought disappears, then concentrate again on the blissful feeling. How many people want the homework? Robbie, can you make some copies, please? It just gets harder and harder. Sorry. Let me see if I can figure out the pages here. No, that's so fine. Just read the book. That's about the bottom line. Oh. Well, you could, yeah. Well, then don't do it. It's too tricky. Too tricky. Two-sided copying. Still trying to teach him how to use his cell phone. Only in emergencies. Any questions about anything? Relevant to this class, that is. I apologize for the having to pay for that thing. But my nanny said when she left at 5:30, she texted me and said, "These shoes are so expensive, I'm going to have to call you to pay for them." Because usually she pays for stuff. So I knew it was going to happen when I got here. I was hoping it wouldn't, but it did. Any questions about, come on people, give me something to chew on here. No questions? Okay, well, I must not be doing my job. All right, let's look at class two here. So the inner heat, let me just say a few words about that. It's kind of interesting. The Duma practice, the Tibetans, like I mentioned, Herbert Benson, he was a Harvard cardiologist who was very interested in transcendental meditation. He wrote a book called, what was that first book on TM? Anyway, Relaxation Response. Yeah. Anyway, he wrote that book. He did a lot of research on meditators. And, for example, he saw that, this is interesting to know, he noticed that people that he did a study, and he taught these people how to meditate, basically, and there was one group that didn't know how and one group that did, and they hadn't meditated much, really. And they showed these people a film of something that was really distressful, which is somebody cutting their finger off in a shop, you know, doing, you know, sawing and stuff, and they actually did cut their finger off. That's the video. The point of that video was to kind of stress you out. And so people, they were able to measure people's stress response from this. And the people that hadn't meditated went kook, and then they took them a long time to come back down. Right? The people that did meditate had an appropriate response, but they came down much more quickly to what you call baseline. So that these are measurable things that, you know, over time, if you do a daily practice, you know, you will become less reactive. You'll know what, you know, or if you react, you'll get back to, you're like, you know, I think Tiger Woods actually said he meditated. And he is not a very nice person from what I can tell, but I don't know for sure. But you know, he cusses and fusses on the golf course, but it's like, and then bam, he's right back down to bit because he's completely composed for the next shot. He's not freaking out or angry or anything when he's hitting the next shot after he just, you know, threw his club in the lake or something or broke it. You know, he's very focused on the next shot. And I know, you know, I've read some stuff about him, and his mother's from Thailand, and he's been doing meditation since he was a kid. So that would explain maybe why he was a Superman golfer, but I think it was more than meditation. I think he had some other tools, plus the great golf karma. Anyway, so, and then this Duma practice, truly, you know, Herbert Benson went to India and had the Dalai Lama found some meditators that were doing this practice, and honestly, these people could go up in the mountains and survive with basically a loincloth in the dead of winter because they could keep their skin warm and their core temperature normal. So they used to put, I need to do it now, don't I? But this sounds ridiculous, but Herbert Benson, I saw a video of this. They used to have contests to see who was the best at it. So it'd be like freezing cold in these monasteries in the morning, and these monks would come out with nothing but their undershorts on, and they put wet sheets on them to see who could dry the most. And within about a couple of minutes, you see steam rising up off these wet sheets. And they were doing this Duma practice. But the point of the inner bliss is to use that blissful consciousness conjoined with your understanding of reality to cut through delusions, not just bliss for bliss' sake, but to actually use it to get enlightened. So it's, the motivation is huge. Pardon?
Can I keep out the homework while you're talking?
You can. That'd be fine. So last time I said, be prepared to discuss the aspects of Buddhist Tantra that make it speedier path to enlightenment than the Sutra path. We don't really need to talk about that. I think we've talked about it, but just simply, it is a resultant path, so I think that helps, right? It takes the future result, one, our own enlightenment, our future enlightenment, and we imagine that, we're definitely connected to that continuum, and that we are that now. We're using our imagination, all the while knowing that we're not enlightened right now. But we imagine that we are. It's kind of interesting. It sounds contradictory, but it's not. All right. And so that's, that. And then the other part of it that's a little bit hard to explain, a little bit hard to get, is that in the Sutra path, your understanding of, this, we talk about two wings of the bird, method and wisdom, right? So in Sutra, the method, the principal method is compassion or bodhicitta, and the principal wisdom is the same wisdom of emptiness. It's just, there's no difference between the wisdom in the Sutra and Tantric path. But in the Tantric path, the method, the principal method is deity yoga. Okay? And so the wisdom, so they say in the Sutra path that you can't practice method and wisdom in the same moment with the same moment of mind. So it's not as powerful. You have to go back and forth. Compassion, wisdom, compassion, wisdom, compassion, wisdom. And they kind of bleed into one another, but they're never happening in the same moment of mind. And it seems to be really, really important that they happen in the same moment of mind with a subtle laser-like consciousness. So the deity yoga, the deity is the method, and the wisdom of emptiness is the wisdom of emptiness, and they're conjoined together in the same moment. And I could say more about that, but I won't, because it just confuse people. But they're conjoined together in the same moment of mind. So method and wisdom are happening in the same moment, in the same package. And that's said to be much, much more powerful than when you're having to go back and forth. And so that's another unique feature of Tantra. And then, of course, I think, another reason that Tantra is so speedy is that we have such, what do we say? What you think you become. So, everybody, there's a lot of platitudes like that. But, if you think that you're this, our self-talk has been said many times in the text and in this class is that, normally we have such a limited view of our potentials. We think, I'm done this, I'm that, but very, very limited view. We certainly don't think, most of us, I'm just guessing, don't think that we have the potential to be a Buddha. It doesn't even occur to me that I could be a Buddha normally. Doesn't even occur to me. It sounds ridiculous. sounds like some kind of a Napoleonic thing, you know, where you like you have this delusion of grandeur. But in Tibetan, you know, in Tantra, what you're doing is you're dissolving all the stories you made up about yourselves, your entire life, your history, whatever you think is going to happen in the future, all of that was just made up anyway. It's not true. It's not inherently true. It's just made up. It's just a fiction. So understanding the true nature of reality, we're able to let go of all of that crap and dissolve it into the space of emptiness, right? And then from within the space of emptiness and sort of motivated by compassionate wisdom, particularly this bodhicitta motivation, motivated by compassion, you know, we, and within this spirit of wisdom, this perception of wisdom that we have, whatever it is, we imagine we're the Buddha now. Like I am a perfect being. I have perfect power, compassion, loving kindness, you know, skillful means, all the qualities of enlightened being now. I mean, and we, you know, we operate from that place of being, you know, a completely realized being. Now it said in the beginning, it's more important, and then you sort of, you do something that's kind of strange. You want to get as clear appearance of yourself as you can of the deity. Remember, I would ask people to think about Green Tara and being this green lady, completely made of light, beautiful, everything perfect about her, and she is and her green color is important. The colors of these deities are important. That's when you come up to a green light, you go. She's about going. Compassionate action. She's all about the action of compassion. So you are Tara now. I am Tara. And you say, and so you try to get as clear appearance of yourself as this female deity made of light. Every atom of her existence, which is not solid, is empty. And it exists solely for the benefit of others. Right. Yeah, so that's who you are. And then you have pride. This sounds weird. Lama Yeshe calls it divine pride. He's like, I am Tara. This is not divine. You're not having pride in yourself, your ordinary self. You have pride or the sort of divine identity. Lama Yeshe calls it divine pride. It's not afflictive pride. Afflictive pride is arrogance, and this is not that. This is divine pride in your qualities as an enlightened being now. So it's really important. That's more important in the beginning than a clear appearance of yourself as a deity, is to think, okay, I have Buddha nature. I am a Buddha now. I have these qualities now. I can become, you know, I am an enlightened being now. All the time, understanding the difference between fantasy and reality, not, you know, going around, you know, this is why you have to be sane to practice Tantra. Because if you really think you're enlightened and you go around telling everybody that, you know, they got places for people like that. And it won't, you know, it doesn't work like that. You really have to be able to differentiate fantasy from reality. But you're using your imagination, which is so powerful, to develop your mind. You're using your own mind to develop your mind. How cool is that? Okay. So that's one of the reasons Tantra is really powerful, because we are limited, sort of poor me, I could never do that. I call it spiritual inferiority complex. Doesn't happen in Tantra. We have, if anything, we have a superiority complex. You know, in Tantra, we really do have, you know, so Our attitude is everything. If your attitude is that you're, you know, worthless piece of, you know what? That's how you show up in the world. If you think that you're a worthy human being, you know, and that you're confident and, you know, for the right reasons, and you're not arrogant, but you're just, you know, you can be humble and confident and powerful and all of these things. It just depends on the mind of the individual. It's really important. So this is, Tantra is powerful in that way. Secret Mantra is a synonym for Tantra. Explain why Tantra is secret and the meaning of the term mantra. So why is Tantra secret? I'm going to go off on a tangent here, but not really. Why is Tantra secret? Robbie, would you read this? It's only 3 pages long. No, I'll read some of it. All right. I think this is important. Alex Berzin, this is from Alex's website. He talked about tantric imagery. And I know nobody here, we flushed all the people out of the class here the first night who came here because they thought this was about exotic sexual techniques. And we asked people to leave. Pardon? But I'm serious. On the street, the pedestrian mentality is that's a lot of what Tantra is. So Alex is speaking to that. And I think this is, I'll stop reading when I think I'm boring everybody. But anyway, one of the more perplexing and most easily misunderstood aspects of Tantra is its imagery suggestive of sex. Kama Chakra, male and female. Okay? That statue could easily be seen as pornography. Okay? There's a reason it's covered up from the waist down. Okay? So, suggestive of sex, devil worship, and violence. Buddha figures often appear as couples in union and have many demonic faces. Kama Chakra's face is pretty wrathful looking. Stand enveloped in flames and trample helpless beings beneath their feet. Seeing these images horrified many early Western scholars who often came from Victorian or missionary backgrounds. So, one reason to keep it quiet. Even nowadays, some people believe that couples signify the sexual exploitation of women. Others imagine that couples in union represent the transcendence of all duality, the point that there's no difference between good and bad. They think that consequently, Tantra is immoral and not only sanctions, but even encourages the usage of alcohol and drugs and hedonistic, criminal, or despotic behavior. And this has happened. All of these things have happened in the name of Tantra since it's come to this country. Some go as far as accusing well-respected tantric masters of plotting to take over the world. I've not heard that one. Westerners were not the first to declare Tantra a degenerate form of Buddhism. When Tantra originally came to Tibet in the mid-18th century, many took the imagery literally as granting free license to ritual sex and blood sacrifice. Subsequently, in the early 19th century, a religious council banned further official translation of tantric text and prohibited the inclusion of tantric terminology in the dictionary. One of the main incentives for the Tibetans inviting Indian masters for the second spread of Buddhism in Tibet was to clarify misunderstanding about sex and violence in Tantra. Not all Westerners who have had early contact with Tantra found the imagery depraved. A number misunderstood it in other ways. Some, for example, felt that the sexual imagery symbolized the psychological process of integrating masculine and female principles within each person. Others, like many early Tibetans, found the images erotic. Even now, some people turn to Tantra hoping to find new and exotic sexual techniques or spiritual justification for their obsession with sex. So others found the terrifying figures alluring for their promise of granting extraordinary powers. Some people followed in the footsteps of the 13th century mogul conqueror Kublai Khan, who adopted Tibetan Tantra primarily in the wish that it would help him gain victory over his foes. Misunderstandings about Tantra, then misunderstanding about Tantra then is a perennial problem. The reason for Tantra's insistence on secrecy about its teachings and images is to avoid such misconceptions, not to hide something perverse. Only those with sufficient preparation in study and meditation have the background to understand Tantra. I don't really need to say a lot more. You know, there's some of the wrathful. I will say a little bit. You can look this up in Alex's website, you know. This is called Tantric Imagery. Just, you know, Tantric Imagery, Alex Berzin. And you'll B-E-R-Z-I-N. All right. Here's one little section on peaceful and forceful figures. Let me see if we can find a forceful figure here. Wrathful. Well, right over there with, that is Vaishravana. Yeah, but below Vaishravana is a black, you know, figure with fire coming out of every pore in his body, so to speak, if you knew what that was.
That's Dorji Chandra.
Yeah, Dorji Chandra is sort of a wrathful one. But, there are lots of these, what we call wrathful Buddha figures. Or the term deities is the term you see a lot, but Alex uses the word Buddha figures. He thinks deity sounds a little bit too Judeo-Christian. Buddha figures may be peaceful or forceful, as indicated on the simplest level by their having smiles on their faces or fangs bared. More elaborately, forceful figures have terrifying faces, hold an arsenal of weapons. There's some weapons over there. You know, in the colored chakra, on the colored chakra, and stand surrounded by flames. Description of them specify in gory detail various ways in which they smash their enemies. Part of the confusion that arises about the role and intent of these forceful figures comes from the usual translations of the word for them, troa, or angry or wrathful deities. For many Westerners with a biblical upbringing, the term wrathful deity carries the connotation of an almighty God with righteous, vengeful anger. Such a being metes out divine punishment as retribution for evildoers who have disobeyed its laws and somehow offended it. For some people, a wrathful deity may even connote the devil or a demon working on the side of darkness. The Buddhist concept has nothing to do with such notions. Good. Although the Tibetan term derives, the Tibetan term derives from one of the usual words for anger. Anger here has more the connotation of repulsion, a rough state of mind directed toward an object with the wish to get rid of it. Thus, a more appropriate translation for troa would be a forceful figure. Forceful figures symbolize the strong, energetic means. This is important because, you know, sometimes just being nice and kind doesn't get it done. Sometimes a kick in the butt is how you get it done, right? So, forceful figures symbolize the strong, energetic means often, and that can be compassion too, right? It can be based on wisdom and compassion. Forceful means can be purely, you know, perfect at the right time and the right moment. Forceful figures symbolize the strong, energetic means often required to break through mental and emotional blocks that prevent one from becoming clear-headed or compassionate. The enemies that the figures smash include dullness, laziness, and self-centeredness. The weapons they use span positive qualities developed along the spiritual path, such as concentration, enthusiasm, and love. The flames that surround them are the different types of deep awareness that burn away obscurations. Imagining oneself as a forceful figure helps to harness the mental energy and resolve to overcome internal enemies. From the Buddhist perspective, the subtlest energy of the clear light continuum, that's the subtlest, most powerful mind we talk about. So we talk about in Tantra, there's growth, subtle and subtlest energy. Now we're talking about the subtlest, most powerful energy that we want to be able to tap into and can only do through the practice of Tantra. So he says, The subtlest energy of clear light continuum may be peaceful or forceful. When associated with confusion, the peaceful and forceful energies and the emotional states that they underlie become destructive. For example, peaceful energy becomes lethargic and forceful energy becomes angry and violent. When rid of confusion, the energies may readily combine with concentration and discriminating awareness so that they are available for positive, constructive use. With peaceful energy, one may calm oneself and others to deal with difficulties in a level-headed manner. With forceful energy, one may rouse oneself and others to have more strength, courage, and intensity of mind to overcome dangerous situations. So that's pretty cool. You know, there's lots of different ways. Yeah.
It's kind of an old axiom, even in Western esoteric traditions, where the nastier and meaner and more wrathful a deity looks, the more he's your friend.
Okay, well, I like that. That works for me. All right. Any questions about what we've just been talking about? We talked about the misunderstandings about the, you know, whatever.
Don?
Yes.
The exercise we did is something that I've done in Kundalini practice. Of course, it felt very similar.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just curious. So
that is Kundalini. This is Rasa the Kundalini. That's the term that they do use in Tantra.
Okay. So how is it? And of course, it's in Hindu and Indian Tantra that we end up with the more sexual components of it. And that's a big part of it. Now, with the Tibetan Tantra, it's exclusively for liberation and enlightenment, correct?
Boy, I tell you, I'm not really. This is how I've gotten myself into trouble. But I will tell you, I will say this. I'm not really that knowledgeable about Hindu Tantra. I do know that the big difference between Hindu Tantra and Buddhist Tantra, Buddhist Deity Yoga, because Deity Yoga is in Hinduism, by the way. You know, you go to India or any kind of Hindu temple and there are deities all over. There's lots of deities. But the biggest difference is emptiness. And it is a practice of emptiness. When you emanate yourself as the deity, you know, you're doing it from within the space of emptiness. So it's, you know, your ego, your concrete sense of self has been dissolved. I don't know if that's the answer to your question, but that's how I understand. That's the biggest difference. And then the motivation is maybe different too. To get enlightened for the sake of all beings as quickly as possible.
Right.
I don't think that's in Hinduism.
No, actually it's not. It's for personal power.
Yeah.
And hopefully you use the power well, but
yeah,
it's for personal
power. I keep saying Darth Vader was, you know, maybe, I don't know if he's Hindu, but at least he was a tantric practitioner gone wrong, you know. Anyway.
I think it was Edward Conze that noted that given all the vows and disciplines of Tantra, if it's just for sex, you're going through a lot of work just to get laid.
It's a lot of work. You're right. A lot of work. Yeah, and this is no joke. I don't want to say, because I don't really know that much about it, but you know that, you know, for example, once you've taken a tantric empowerment, let's say to become, you know, a deity yoga, once you've taken the empowerment, if you, for example, have taken the empowerment in Tara, for example, or you take an empowerment in Medicine Buddha, or whatever it is, whatever empowerment you've taken, you are, from that moment on, 24/7, you're to see yourself as a deity and not an ordinary being anymore. Like, ordinary appearances is considered to be our biggest obstacle, right? Because ordinary appearance is inherent existence. We see, we have no concept, consciously, 99.9, I mean, only when I came to this class and started thinking about it, most of the time we don't think that we're creating our reality constantly. We think the reality's coming at us. Everybody sees it the same way and all of that. And that's ordinary appearance. And so Tantra really challenges ordinary appearance, particularly of ourself and then our universe. Instead of seeing our world as just ordinary, we're supposed to see it as this, a mandala. Like, and we're part of that. You know, we're part of this mandala, which is a celestial environment. And everybody in it is a deity. You know, and they're there, whatever they do, we're supposed to have what's called pure view. And then there's a mantra, as we've talked about, that goes along with each of the deities, these sacred syllables. The mind has a tendency to go on and on, conceptualize, right, and talk. We have a tendency to talk to ourselves. Well, better harness the energy of mantra, right? The pure energy of mantra, it has meaning. Whether we understand it, like if you say Om Tari Tutari Tuti Soha, you don't have to know what it means. And there's a translation, Lama Zopa translated it. But it's not, you have some faith in the mantra, and then you just say the mantra. And you have some sense that it has a positive meaning and that there's a vibration associated with that sound that resonates with your innermost being, your Buddha nature, and it will help grow that Buddha nature. Some of this is faith. But again, people have practiced this for a long time and have said it works. So this is why the Tantric Master is so precious and important, because until you see the proof is in the pudding, right? You see the Tantric Master, you see this extraordinary human being who's like living on a level that we can't even imagine. I see Lama Zopa Rinpoche. I mean, he doesn't sleep for years, doesn't lay down for years. You go, how can any human being do that? And again, people say, and I know this because I mean his attendants, the people who take care of him, this went on for years and years, and his compassion, he reads people's minds, especially mine, and he's extraordinarily capable in helping others. And so when you meet somebody like that, it gives you a lot of confidence in the path, that this is a valid path. But hearing me say that's not going to make it for you. You have to go out and meet. You have to go out and actually have that experience yourself. Yeah.
If you're supposed to see yourself as the deity 24/7, mm-hmm. can you do more than one tantric initiation to do two?
Absolutely, absolutely. And many, many people, have taken, many tantric initiations. But generally speaking, let's say if you were doing a retreat on Green Tara, let's say you have a yidam, okay? A yidam is your tutelary, is that the right word? Your main guy or gal, so to speak. It's your main deity. So your main deity might be the medicine Buddha, or it might be Kalachakra, or it might be Haruka, or it might be Yamantaka, or it might be Gaya Samadhi. Who knows? If it's a highest yoga tantra deity, it would be one of those that I mentioned. It would be Kalachakra, Gaya Samadhi, Haruka, or Yamantaka. Those are the four main in the Galupa tradition. But if it was in the Kriya Tantra, it might be like Thousand Arm Chinrezig, or Green Tara, or Medicine Buddha. Let's say it was Medicine Buddha. You know, you would take, let's say that's the deity. You ask, your teacher said, what is my main practice to put all of my energy in? And it would be the Medicine Buddha. So ordinary 24/7 during your life, you would see yourself as the Medicine Buddha. But if you were doing a retreat on Green Tara for 2 weeks, you would imagine yourself as Green Tara for that time. At different times, you could imagine yourself as any deity. For example, if you wanted to access your potential for healing, you might see yourself as the as a medicine Buddha. If you wanted to access compassionate action, you might see yourself as Green Tara. So you can, if you have some familiarity with these different deities and what they symbolize, if you want to have, if you want to access your wisdom, you might see yourself as Manjushri. I'm sorry, yeah, Manjushri. Or if you want to access your wrathful wisdom, Yamantaka, like that.
So, but I'm saying if you, you can have two initiations. One.
You can have hundreds of initiations.
Okay. I mean, not that I've had any, but,
yeah,
you know, just next life.
Yeah, well, you know, it's, again, that's part of the reason for this class is to, is for you to get some sense of whether this is the right path for you to tread in the future when the opportunity arises. You know, Geshe-la's teacher comes here, Lama Zopa comes here. Every now and then we'll have, and then you can go places where the Dalai Lama's teaching. You could actually be in India right now and taking the Kala Chakra if you were in Ladakh or someplace like that. But anyway, yeah. So, yes.
Something that tends to lead me to some confusion is the fact that people do take more than one initiation. But then normally when you take an initiation, you get a commitment to go with it.
Yeah.
Now, if you had 100 initiations and had to do 100 commitments for it every day, you wouldn't be getting anywhere.
Very good point. You know,
but on the other hand, sometimes you have, oh, say, 3 or 4 that you're really interested in working with.
Yeah.
But, you know, okay, so you can work with one or, at a time, but you still have to be commitments on the others,
right.
And some of them are easier, right? I mean,
yeah.
Yamantaka is a 30-day retreat that goes to that.
Right.
Vajrayogini is not a very long retreat.
Yeah.
If you say wanting to follow through in Gaya Samaja, that's 6 months. That's a long time for most people, right?
Well, it's not 6 months. It's more like 6 weeks, but it's still... It's a long
only
time.
6 weeks for Gaya Samaja?
Gaya Samaja, I think 6 weeks. Yeah. But anyway, maybe it's different sadhana. Depends on the sadhana and the mantra count that the guru gives you. Uh-huh. So I mean, a lot of these sadhanas are, they take an hour or 2 hours to read. You know, they're guided visualizations that you do in retreat. They may take an hour or more to do just to read through it, and then you want to meditate on it, not just speed through it. So, but yeah, that's a good point. There's a saying, which is kind of spooks the Tibetans. It said the Indians used to take initiation in one deity and realize that deity. And the Tibetans would take initiations in, you know, many, many deities and realize none of them.
Yeah.
So the point is you want to become Haruka. You want to become Tara. You want to actually so closely identify. You know, right now we identify with this body, this gross body, but eventually, you know, with practice, we can, and with repeated familiarization, we can actually begin to see ourselves as a deity, and having, and beginning to have some acknowledgement of our, you know, our potential, our potentials rather than poor me. I could never do that. Okay, so time is up. We got 1 minute. Any last questions? You had your hand up. Oh, you were just scratching your head. Okay. So it's, did you hand, you handed out the homework?
Yeah.
Okay. So we didn't, next week we will do the Tara practice. And, pardon?
Yeah.
Oh my goodness. I forgot about that. There's no class next week.
The 30th?
I believe that's correct.
Because it's July 4th week, I guess. I don't know.
Yeah, that's correct. So the week, the day after, the Monday night after July 4th weekend,
okay,
we'll meet again. So you have a lot of time to practice Tara. And there's actually, I don't know if the sadhana is out there, but there's a nice little, not that long sadhana, probably, 5 or 10 pages. It used to be in the bookstore. It's kind of sweet, and it's could be a nice daily practice, although that 1.5 page that Lama Zopa had in the text is also good. So let's do the dedication verses. May all beings everywhere plagued by the sufferings of body and mind obtain an ocean of happiness and joy by virtue of my merits. May no living creature suffer, commit evil, or ever fall ill. May no one be afraid of a little with the mind weighed down by depression. May the blind see forms and the deaf hear sounds. May those whose bodies are worn with toil be restored on finding repose. May the naked find clothing, the hungry find food. May the thirsty find water and delicious drinks. May the poor find wealth, those weak with sorrow find joy. May the forlorn find hope, constant happiness, and prosperity. May there be timely rains and bountiful harvest. May all medicines be effective and wholesome prayers bear fruit. May all who are sick and ill quickly be free from the ailments. Whatever diseases there are in the world, may they never occur again. May the frightened cease to be afraid and those bound be freed. May the powerless find power and may people think of benefiting each other. As long as sentient beings remain, may I too remain to the miseries of the world. I don't have that. Okay. All right, so thank you for your attention, and you have some homework to do. My suggestion is to finish reading the text, or, you know, you've got a couple of weeks to do that. And then if you have questions, please write them down. You know, sometimes you may feel, or you could write them down and turn them in if you feel like you don't want to, you know, ask questions in a crowd of people. Just hand them in, and I'll try to answer them. Or better yet, I'll put them to Geshe Gelek. Let him answer them. Anyway, thank you.